King of the Worshippers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a special commentary from Chris Hedges from Truth Dig, Worshiping the Electronic Image. But from Health and Nutrition today, we're also going to learn about the holy herb. It's showing promise in treating Alzheimer's disease from the Salk Institute. I'll tell you what that herb is. We have a lot of people listening right now who know someone who are having mental conditions. Also, what happens when you're finally 45, 50, 55? You've put a lot of time into your family, your career, your relationships, to yourself. And you just want some easy time now because you've climbed those mountains, you've been in the valleys. We all go through these ups and downs in life. And then you get the call that mom's having problems with her memory. Dad has got Parkinson's or they have a heart attack. What do you do then? Well, as a good kid, you go to their aid. That's what you're supposed to do. And you shouldn't even have to be told that. And most people don't. They understand the preciousness of life, and they wouldn't be here without that person who's now suffering. And so you go to help them. But are you prepared for that? Do you have any way of understanding what that will mean as far as stress, upending your own balance of life? How do you keep your balance when everything is about to change and you're unprepared for it? Time permitting, I'll discuss that. If not, I'll do that on an entire the Progressive Commentary Hour. Also today, I'm going to begin a series of audio clips this week that'll be revealing. One of the most revealing will also be followed by a commentary and a two-part series of the UN when I was invited by the United Nations to give their chief address on Earth Day. And I did not make it easy on those sitting in the audience, the majority of whom were from environmental organizations, because I simply asked a question. With all the hundreds of millions of dollars the environmental movement makes each year, why have you not joined together on a single cause? Not one. And why is it none of you are going after the culprits? Not one of you. You deal in vague euphemisms, but nothing gets done. And then I explained why, how many people funding them were at the actual cause of environmental degradation. We're going to take it one step further. We're going to show you this week and prove that much of what's going on right now in the environmental movement is corrupt. It has been captured, cleverly so, almost ingeniously so, because the people in the streets are there with good intention, and I respect that. They're protesting climate change. They want to see it changed, but it's the people behind it and what the real agenda is. They support 5G. Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah. Yep. They support it big time. How do we know? Well, we got a list of all their donors, and all their donors are all the telecom industry, and they've even put it in writing. And at a conference, I guess no one thought would pay attention, they talked about the importance of smart meters and 5G and smart cities and the connection of all things internet. Well, who's that benefit? That's a leading cause of global warming. So anyhow, they're going to be exposed this week for the first time on this show. Also, the woman who was hounded and crucified up in Canada, chiropractor, metaphorically speaking, for talking against GMOs and vaccines safety. They took away her license to practice chiropractic, put her under psychiatric care, and determined that she had delusions. No, she's just a normal, educated woman activist. Nobody went to her aid. I just spoke to her today, And we're going to bring on the show and show you how crazy that damn Trudeau, but Trudeau himself, geez, man, this guy is such a, whoa. I won't get into that now. We'll save it. I'll go through the 100 things wrong with Canada and their government and what they've done to the Indigenous people. And it will be a reflection of what they really represent. And this is just the latest manifestation of stopping all freedom of speech on a topic you don't want to hear. Today, you're also going to hear Richard Gell come on because we're going to play you a clip. We have a problem at our borders. I've given you many ideas of how we could solve that, how in a humane and in a spiritual and in a very open and loving way we could take in people, house them, help them, get them to assimilate so they can be able to live quality lives without fear of being either manipulated and used for cheap farm labor or joining a gang. And how do you do that? It's not difficult. But instead, both the Democrats and Republicans, Clinton did it. Obama built those cages. He built those detention centers. He deported more people than any president. In fact, all the presidents combined, Obama did. Not a criticism towards Obama. So when you're criticizing Trump, and there's a lot of things to criticize Trump on, but you don't criticize Obama and Clinton, then you've weaponized the debate. So now they're not just detention centers. Inhumane, yes. Cold and unthinking, yes. Profitizing by having $740 a night per person. And these people are all politically connected, first to Clinton's, then Obama's, now to Trump, yes. Concentration camps, absolutely not. And we shouldn't allow this to be equated to a concentration camp, because then they're weaponizing terms that should stay burnt in our collective psyche of what extreme suffering and termination of life and deprivation of every human value was to those 6 to 7 million Jews, gypsies, communists, socialists who suffered in ways that are unimaginable to young snowflakes who have no reality of life at all and should not be taken seriously because they haven't experienced life. They sure as hell have never had a number printed on their arm. And you should be ashamed of yourself, those in the liberal community who said, yeah, there are American concentration camps. How dare you? How dare you? Every Jew in the world should be up in arms over this. But that's what happens when you're smart enough to weaponize an argument. And that's what they've done. Neither group wants to see a solution to the suffering at the border because you can profit from it. And we shouldn't allow these people in Washington to do that. So we're going to take this on today. But it's not me who's going to be taking it on. No, I got a surprise for you. And then you can call in and share your points of view. Also, you think that nuclear is clean and green? Well, someone's going to be on who says yes and makes a very compelling argument. But then, to balance that, we're going to have some scientists who shows that it's not clean and it's not green. This you won't want to miss. So let's go. First up, there is an herb. It's called Yerba, Y-E-R-B-A, Santa, S-E-N-T-A. And it's able to treat brain swelling in dementia patients. Now, this is according to the Salk Institute. So a shrub known as Yerba Santa, and it's also dubbed the holy herb in Spanish, is showing great promise in treating Alzheimer's disease, and it can reduce brain swelling. And it's native to California, where there's a lot of brain swelling for simply living out there, especially KPFK and KPFA. They have the perpetual brain swelling. But researchers at Salk Cellular Neurobiology Laboratory in San Diego showed that it could be used to treat serious health problems. In fact, millions of Americans suffer from dementia, and Alzheimer's is only one form of dementia. And according to the professor David Schubert and his team, a molecule in the shrub called sterubin, S-T-E-R-U-B-I-N, the plant's most active compound, is the key to transforming millions of lives. And it's a significant anti-inflammatory to the brain, especially the cells called microglia, microglia, which are involved in the development of Alzheimer's disease. And the researchers found that the stirubin effectively removes iron. And this is an important discovery, as iron contributes to nerve cell damage in the aging brain and neurodegenerative diseases. It was also found to be effective at reducing numerous causes of cell death in the nerve cells. So, how about that? Brand new, good qualified information from a leading respected institute, something natural, non-toxic, can help you with reduced swelling in the brain, dementia, and Alzheimer's. Also, I was asked yesterday in a question, Gary, not everyone's going to be vegan. Yeah, you think? 3% of us are. That's still about 12 million Americans, a lot more in other countries like India. But you're right. Americans are eating more meat and animal proteins, not less. But what happens when we don't have the meat? Well, let them eat grasshoppers and silkworms. Why? According to the University of Teramo in Italy, grasshoppers and silkworms have antioxidant capacity similar to orange juice. So they're the top rich antioxidant insects. And yes, all over the world, people eat insects. And so just something to let you know that the insects are there. This was published in Frontiers Nutrition for those who eat meat and want to know what's possible for the future. From Kyung-hee University in South Korea, published in the American Journal of Clinical Chinese Medicine, fermented red ginseng, remember I keep mentioning red ginseng is the most powerful, alleviates drug-induced immunosuppression and colitis. Now you consider how many Americans suffer from suppressed immune systems. You're dealing with millions. So taking some fermented red ginseng, also called Panax, P-A-N-A-X, and that's partly, it's in the root, makes all the difference in the world. So another thing that can help us. From the University of East Anglia, which is in the United Kingdom, comes a study about nature. Just being in nature reduces the risk of diabetes and heart disease and more. So, in fact, it cuts the risk of diabetes and heart disease and hypertension and stress substantially. Just being around nature, getting into the parks, having a garden, being around butterflies and bumblebees. And it's easy to do. Every day I feed the bumblebees raw organic honey 365 days a year. In the wintertime, I put bales, double thick bales of hay, going 8 feet high, clear around the hive. That way there's no wind chill factor that would kill all the drones and the other bees that have to protect the queen. And they sacrifice themselves. They make barriers knowing they're going to die. And then when the chill factor comes in, they die. In the morning, at least, the queen and the attendant bees are still alive. But when you look at all these commercial farms, they don't protect bees. They're just stupid, really dumb. And they should be called out for being that dumb. And also, to the cattle people, hey, I'm a farmer, I'm a rancher, but I'm there to protect the animals and to save the animals from being hurt or slaughtered. And animals have emotions and they have feelings. And they love each other. They love bonding. But when you put an animal out there in the fields, and you know the weather temperature is going to drop 50 degrees in one day, in 6 hours, in Minnesota, in Wyoming, in North Dakota, and you don't have a barrier for them, that's on you, clown. You shouldn't be a farmer. You should be a politician, then you could get away with this. Shame on the ranchers out there who want to make the money off the meat but don't want to provide it with any protection from the elements. All you had to do is build windproof shelters, inexpensive, easy to do, So at least when the temperature starts to drop, it's generally the wind chill that kills them. They have a place to go into, and you can put these throughout your property. Even if you had 1,000 acres, you can put them, and you can build them so they could be comfortable and not die. But they don't. So they go out the day after, and they're, what, in one place there was 16,000 dead animals. Same way in Australia. That's another country that needs, God, they need some reckoning on a lot of what they've done historically. And the indigenous population definitely needs reparations because of what they've done. In any case, so when you get out into green space and you're around these bees and you realize the bees are going to make one out of every three foods that you eat possible through pollination, so do bats. But then when we are spraying pesticides, we're killing the insects that the bats eat, and therefore they die off. And also bat manure is richer than cow manure and horse manure or chicken manure. It's generally chicken and cow manure that can be degraded down over a period of a year and made into really rich soil enrichment. And then you can grow green plants that cover the soil and hold the soil in place. You don't have erosion. But get yourself out into nature as much as you can. It can help you and could save your life. Also from Andong National University in South Korea, published in the British Medical Journal, Complementary and Alternative Medicine, colorectal cancer cells viability is degraded by extracts from Chinese sweet plum. So a team of researchers at the university examine whether extracts from the leaves and branches of the Chinese sweet plum plant have anti-cancer activity. And the research team published their findings showing, yes, it does. So when you consider how many people have colorectal cancer, something natural, non-toxic, that's easy to get and viable, the Chinese sweet plum extract from the leaves and the branches, that can make a difference. Save a life. Also, healthy lifestyle may offset genetic risk of dementia, according to the University of Exeter. These are the kind of studies I love to read because it shows that even if you should have a genetic susceptibility, you're less likely to manifest that if you make a positive life change. So a healthy living lifestyle can help offset your genetic risk of dementia. Healthy plant-based diet, exercise, proper supplementation, it makes a difference. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. Come right back at you. Please stay with us.
I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world because we are heard all over the world. And I want to thank you for tuning in and more importantly for going to prn.fm and downloading our hundreds of articles that we write. They are all fully researched. There's good scholarship and they're legally vetted so you could use them in a court of law. I want to also mention that I'll be returning to New York. Our documentary is completed, though I am adding a voiceover later today to make us aware that with all the good intentions Americans have to save their planet, there are those behind it who want you to save the planet their way so they can profit from it. Al Gore's one, but only one. And we're going to show you some other examples a little later. So I'm adding in there, not to be confused by the demonstrations in the street, legitimate, the people who are demonstrating, legitimate, the desire to see global change halted, legitimate, and the people who have another agenda behind it, sponsoring 5G, not legitimate. And we're going to give you specifics on that later in the week. I'm going to be doing for many of you, a premiere of a very powerful film. It is called Deadly Deception. Plus, there's going to be a conversation between Leonard Lopate and myself. I've never met Leonard. I've never spoken with Leonard. I'll only meet him that night and see what's on his mind at that time. Plus, I'll be doing answering people's questions. So this will be on the 25th. It's a fundraiser for our sister station where I've been for 44 years, WBAI. Let me give you the number because we are almost filled up, which is good. 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. And so that's that. And also there's I'm going to be at the Huntington Arts Cinema. They don't make it easy to... God, man, they're like up with the hippies in Woodstock. I'm going to be up there also. But they'll come out of their caves where they've been for the last 40 years smoking marijuana and say, "Hey, Gary, what's up, dude? I'm here to show you a film, give a lecture." Okay, and then they'll get high and go to sleep. In any case, at Huntington Arts, if you want to join me out there on the 28th for Sunday afternoon, new premiere, brand new, different film, you have to go to their website, to the Cinema Arts page to purchase tickets. Now, we're going to play you a 10-minute clip. Before we play you the clip, and it's very moving, and if you were able to watch it and we have it posted, I mean, it's the kind of clip that brings tears to your eyes. Because when I'm looking in the faces of those human beings, those sacred souls, especially the children, and they're just struck with absolute fear. They're malnourished. They're fatigued. They've been in boxcars riding with no toilets or sanitation, no food. And now they're separated from their families. And I see that. It breaks my heart. But also what concerns me is when people try to equate the ill-informed and the inhumane way that we're treating the migrants, the people wanting to come in this country, and separating those who should be here from those who are gangsters or trying to engage in child trafficking, etc. But it's been politicized, and the words have been weaponized. And that concerns me, because I do not believe by any stretch of the imagination should you ever confuse and conflate an inhospitable detention center with Auschwitz. And if you do so, turn in your liberal badge, and you don't deserve it. Richard Gale's here. Richard, this really concerns me, and I'm not going to sit back and stay idly quiet when I see this occurring on the left for political and ideological reasons. Your thoughts, please.
Well, Gary, you know, I love liberal democracy, but I am deeply scared about what's happening and the rapid decline of it. Democracy is being threatened, and most of this is because of what you've called before the weaponization of speech. And I think that's been part of this large increase in the extreme polarization that's happened, the lack of respect for diversity and seeing everybody, the other, as an enemy. And after World War II, we didn't have this. There was very little polarization to speak of after World War II. People were, diversity was being recognized. There were a lot of advances happening in terms of the people being able to enter into society regardless of your class and your background. So there was kind of a good period in our time. But right now, our political atmosphere is based on, believing anything that will make us hate or dislike the other that we've already have kind of predisposition towards disliking. It's politics is not about what we favor now, it's about what we hate. Our reason is so skewed, and politics therefore has become so savage. And I'm reminded of Robert Bella, He was a great sociologist, I believe, at Princeton. Can't remember in the 1970s. And he wrote about civil religion, and he kind of identified how American politics is like a religion, and that we, the average American, looks at in a kind of a secular way as democracy is being sacred. We have a president who's a high priest. We elect every during the election cycle. We wise men, wise women. We have these holy books, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. We engage in rituals every year, holidays to recognize famous people and events in U.S. history. But everybody has their own interpretation of this. And then it becomes a fight between these different ideologies of the civil religion that we've kind of created in this country. So there's what's happened is that there's no more a moral discussion that's really based on reason. All of our discussions are based on our gut feelings, and then our politicians and different tribes and clans that make up American society then try to defend it. So we can take, I think, if to look at the comments that are being made about U.S. having concentration camps, the term being used down on the border. I think it's best understood to see this in this great polarization that's happening in both parties, Democrats and Republicans alike, this tribalism that's emerged. And another part of this, I think, is the complete cultural amnesia that pervades our society today. People, the average American has very little historical knowledge about our history. You can go on the street and ask people who fought in the Civil War, and they probably would not be able to tell you which side won. Jay Leno has done this. And we're also experiencing this where I think with social media and this, particularly with the younger generation, which is much more engaged in identity politics than the older generation, everybody wants protection from speech and ideas. Like it used to be, you could be threatened by, well, a bully in a playground would threaten you, but now everybody feels threatened just by ideas and speech. We're in this hyper mental fragility, and this has been going on for probably almost a decade, probably a little less. So it's part of this. In part, you could say that people more and more feel like they're just balloons and the world is still pins. You have to protect yourselves. So I think all this is playing into the liberal, the right, the left perceiving the so-called concentration camps as a way to demean and to further hate, justify the hatred they have towards the Republicans.
And Trump, and I'll have a commentary on Trump in a few minutes if time permits. Let's now go. Thank you, Richard. Let's now go to this documentary, and you'll hear it. The woman in here was a survivor of Auschwitz, and she's the commentator. You'll hear her in here, and you have to hear what she's saying. The photographs she's discussing, or the woman's discussing, are from a book that were taken at Auschwitz, and how the Germans lived and were partying and happy and out picnicking with their children. And at the very same time, another book was taken, at the same time, showing all the people who were coming off the trains, being selected for the shower with the Zircon B and the death gas and crematation, and how efficient the Germans were. But if you looked at the Germans from these photographs, you would never imagine the monsters they're inside. When was the last time we took pictures of all the people working in the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Homeland Security, ICE, and then looked at the people that they've impacted? How about taking pictures of the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic National Convention, all of the feminists who surround themselves with Hillary and Bill Clinton and decide to give him a break and her a break Now, what if at the same time we took pictures of those wonderful moments and happy moments and celebratory moments, we at the same time took pictures of all the people in Yemen and the children who are malnourished and dying and a buzzard waiting to eat one of them, and then the children and women and mothers bombed by American NATO, which is America, in Gaddafi's Libya, and funding and supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda and al-Nusra in Syria. And look at the indigenous cultures who were shot, including the feminist leaders of the Cultural Revolution in Honduras, because Hillary Clinton, again, two books. Now, that is not to equate that Hillary and those supporting her are Nazis. It is a larger metaphor that you would never know the deep and dark and depraved capacities of people in power and federal agencies versus what you see them on the street, or you see them at a high school reunion, you see them in a movie theater or restaurant. That is the metaphor for me, that evil in its larger context disguises itself more often than not. Now to this very disturbing 10-minute clip.
The most notorious death camp the world has ever known. The photographs were taken at a nearby resort in the summer of 1944, when the slaughter was at its height.
They are dead devils. There's something in human flesh, because how you could sit there and know what's happening to people there and enjoy.
December 2006, I received a letter in the mail. This gentleman, who requested to remain anonymous, wrote to the museum and said that he had World War II era photographs in his possession that he thought we might be interested in. He believed the pictures, and he wrote in this letter that he believed the pictures to be taken in and around Auschwitz, Poland. I was quite doubtful of this, actually, because very few people actually have photographs of Auschwitz. As ever, I requested more information from him, and he said, can I just send you the album that I have? And I said, sure. So the beginning of January 2007, an album arrived on my desk, Federal Express, and I opened it up, and there was a photograph album clearly marked Auschwitz, 21 June 1944.
It was found in Germany at the end of the war by an American soldier. The album belonged to Karl Hooker, adjutant to the commander of Auschwitz.
His job was to know everything before the commandant did, and to make sure that things ran smoothly for his boss. The other jobs he had was he supervised a team of women known as Helfereinen, and they were the telecommunications specialists. They were in charge of all communications inside and out of the camp. So every time a transport came in, a group of Jews came in on a train, they would be in charge of saying, this many people came in, this number was selected for forced labor, and this number was selected for the gas chambers. And he would sign off on that before it was telegrammed to Berlin. So he absolutely knew everything that was going on. I think the most chilling thing is the time period that this is taken. These are not random officers who are at this resort. This is the peak. This is the A-team. This is people who were brought in specifically for the summer of 1944.
By this point, at least in terms of Birkenau's killing capacity, it reached its apex. And the killing capacity was so expanded that for body disposal, they were beginning to use open pit cremation beyond the crematories.
In those photographs, I recognized Dr. Joseph Mengele. And so once we saw him, then we knew the album was truly something really special, because as we knew, there weren't any, supposedly any photographs of Mengele taken in the camp.
Mengele, known as the Angel of Death, conducted heinous medical experiments on women and children. In perhaps the most remarkable photograph in the album, here he stands amidst a gallery of leading Nazi killers at a sing-along.
Now, the front row of the album, to me, is the most interesting because it's the hierarchy. But they're all in a row, they're all lined up, they're all smiling and laughing at the sing-along. I mean, at the end of one of the most horrific periods of murder in one place in human history. It's astonishing, the photograph.
Besides Josef Mengele, whose face is quite well known, probably the most important person that I recognized was Rudolf Höss, who was the founder of Auschwitz as a concentration camp.
That's, I think, 13 and 26 June.
A year after first viewing them, researchers at the Holocaust Memorial Museum are still finding new clues in these rare photographs.
And look at this guy. Isn't that Enno Lahling? Take the cap off.
I think you're right.
Not long after this picture was taken, Regina Spiegel, an 18-year-old Polish Jew, was deported to Auschwitz.
All these wrinkles, old age isn't even nice to the tattoos. It was like, it looked to me like a fountain pen, you know, and they just jabbed it out and whatever. And sometimes people would ask me, did it hurt? I said, this was the least of our problem. We had other problems. This was the least of our problems.
There were no sing-alongs in Regina's world, only a deep, dark abyss from which she thought she'd never emerge. Just how dark that abyss was can be seen in the only other Auschwitz album known to exist. The Lily Jacob album was named after the woman who discovered the photographs, including this one of her younger brothers, murdered a short time later.
It's really impossible to look at one without really looking at the other. And this is what was actually going on in Auschwitz. This is the reality of the situation, not this world of fun.
In a remarkable coincidence, the photographs in both albums were taken at the same time.
That album was created by the SS for SS purposes. It was created to, presumably, to document what a selection process looked like from the beginning until just to the antechamber of the gas chambers.
Between the middle of May and the beginning of July 1944, 437,000 Hungarian Jews were sent to Auschwitz. 80% were selected for death upon arrival. These women and children, unbeknown to them, are taking their last steps towards the gas chambers.
When they told us to go into the showers, that's so help me God, like, I will never forget. It was the first time that I pushed myself in because I figured maybe they are burning us, so I figured might as well do it to me first so I don't hear anybody else scream. And I, of course, I came out wet, minus my hair. And of course, that's when they put my number on. But that was Auschwitz for me.
I really think that the album in the coming years will be of great interest to people who study the psychology of genocide and the psychology of perpetrators, because it's really astonishing that they can do this. You know, the blueberry pictures in particular, those pictures were taken on a day where transports were coming into Auschwitz 20 miles away, and people are pretending to cry in these images that they don't have any more blueberries to eat. I mean, the duality of this is astonishing. So I think the album also raises questions of bystander. You know, are these girls as guilty as the people putting the Zyklon B in the gas chamber? I mean, they're at Auschwitz, they know what's going on. Where does guilt fall?
The images seared into Regina's mind are of the family, friends, and neighbors these men sent to their deaths.
I could see their haunted faces. And you know, it's a funny thing. When they took him away. They didn't beg them for mercy because they knew there was no mercy. But they turned around to us when we were still standing on the supper. Please remember us. Remember us. Because nobody likes to go into oblivion, not to be remembered.
Worth thinking about before we weaponize words and use them in ways that are not intended. We as a society have failed because we've allowed these degenerates that we call our representatives, liberals and conservatives, to represent the people. And these are not what any reasonable and responsible person would want to see happen. We don't want to see anyone separated from their children. We don't want to see people kept in cages. We don't want to see people treated as if they have no sense of a human value. Now, this is a political process, but because of the politics take center stage of everything in America and the advantages that then pours forth to those who control it, we are not looking for solutions for the immigration crisis, which would be relatively easy to do and humane. And hence, we continue to go in a misdirected way, all because of the politics. Tomorrow I'll give a deeper commentary upon the history of gulags, the Soviet Union. In fact, before even any prisoner was thrown into one of the Soviet gulags, and there were hundreds of thousands, and before anyone entered Auschwitz or any of the other dozens of concentration camps, you even had concentration camps in Cuba when they sought independence from Spain, and where hundreds of thousands of people were put behind barbed wires, and they didn't mass exterminate them. They didn't have to. They simply starved them to death. 150,000 died. And the United States said that it was concerned, but it wasn't, because once we took over Cuba, we kept all the camps, and then we went to the Philippines. Long ago, I posted a photograph with over 2 million skulls. We're alleging 2 million skulls, but we killed over 2 million Filipinos. And you can go clear back. You can go back to the Boer Wars, where the British put together the concentration camps for the people of South Africa. And you can go to America, to all of the native reservations and the Spanish missions. And those were all vulnerable people who were given no freedoms, where they could travel, where they could go to school. And then we started the desecration of whatever resources they had. And many times they were slaughtered as well. There was even a bounty on every head of a Native American California. So in making our claim that we are remarkable, do not leave the chapter out of what we've done in the process, including 20 million people throughout the world we have killed since the end of the World War II. That's 20 million. By any measure, that is also genocide. Now to a problem that we always have, and that is with having the most powerful human being in the world, the President of the United States, and we bring him forward and give him a forum. Now, people elected him, so the issue is not in the electing of him. The issue is more important, and listen to him. He is a functional illiterate, and it's an embarrassment. Donald Trump, like much of the American people, is entranced by what? The electronic images. According to Chris Hedges, he interprets reality, and I think you would agree, through the distortions of digital media. His decisions and opinions and political positions and prejudices and a sense of self are reflected back to him on screens. He views himself and the world around him as a vast television show with himself as the star. His primary concerns as president are his ratings, his popularity, and his image. he's a creature, maybe the poster child of the modern post-literate culture, of a culture that critics call, well, I remember one critic, Marshall McLuhan, M-C-L-U-H-N, as well as, I might mention, Daniel Boorstin and James Carey and Neil Postman. They said, these people will come, and they have. It is not, as some have suggested, merely that Trump speaks at the level of a seventh grader, or that he harkens back to a pre-literate oral culture. He embodies the incoherence of the modern digital age, filled with sudden shifts from subject to subject, a roller coaster ride of emotional highs and lows, punctuated with commercials. There is nonstop stimulation. In fact, seldom does anyone truly understand what he's saying. And in Trump's world, seldom does anything occupy our attention for more than a few seconds. Nothing has context. Images overwhelm words. We are perpetually confused, but always entertained. We barely remember what we saw or heard a few minutes ago. This is by design of the elites who manipulate us. It is a mistake to see what is happening as cultural regression. It is worse than that. Oral cultures prize memorization and cultivated the high art of rhetoric. Leaders and playwrights and poets and oral cultures did not speak to their publics in Trump's crude vernacular. More ominous than the president's impoverished vocabulary is that he cannot string together sentences that make sense. This replicates not only the shoddy vocabulary of television, but more importantly, the incoherence of television. Trump is able to communicate with tens of millions of Americans, all also raised in front of screens, because they too have been linguistically and intellectually muted by digital images. They lack the ability to detect lies or even think rationally. They are part of our post-truth culture. Nearly any tweet or spoken remark by Trump illustrates this incoherence. Let me be specific. In a January 31st interview with the New York Times, he gave this answer when asked about the gruesome murder of the journalist that we've spoken about on this program, Jamal Khashoggi, in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Quote, "Yeah, Khashoggi, I thought it was a terrible crime. But if you look at other countries, many other countries, you look at Iran, not so far away from Saudi Arabia, and take a look at what they're doing there, so you know, that's just the way I feel. Venezuela's very much in flux. We've been hearing about it for probably 14 years now, between the two of them, and some terrible things are happening in Venezuela. So if I can do something to help people, it's really helping humanity. If you can do something to help people, I'd like to do that," end quote. Whoa. Electronic images are our modern-day idols. We worship the power and fame they impart. We yearn to become idolized celebrities. We measure our lives against the fantasies these images disseminate. If something does not appear on a screen or is proclaimed on a screen, its authenticity is questioned. We fervently build miniature social media platforms where we daily update our life, the movie, confusing self-preservation with genuine communication and friendship. This yearning to be validated by electronic images and their audiences has made us an isolated, uninformed, alienated, and very unhappy people. So, the fixation on electronic images by Trump means he and millions of other Americans, according to a 2018 report by the Nielsen Company, on average watch 4 hours and 46 minutes of television each day and spend over 11 hours per day listening to and watching and reading or generally interacting with media. And they've severed themselves from complex thought. They have been infantilized. Television, including the news, reduces all reality to childish, cartoonish simplicity. The news I didn't mean infanticide. I mean the fantasy of a child. So that's what we have today. We're given our truths on screens that provides degenerate photographs or a psycho-reality of stereotypes. James Carey writes that news can approximate truth only when reality is reduced to a statistical table. Sports scores, stock exchange reports, births, deaths, marriages, accidents, court decisions, elections, economic transactions such as foreign trade or balance of payments. When news on our screens is incapable of imparting complexity and nuance, it is devoid of historical and social and cultural context. TV news speaks in easily digestible cliches and political and cultural tropes. It is sensational and fragmented. The frenetic pace of TV news means that except when delivering statistics, the programs can trade only in established stereotypes. TV news is, in essence, divorced from the real, mindlessly grounded in the ruling elite's reigning ideology of neoliberalism, militarism, and white supremacy. If you haven't read the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, by Postman, definitely do so. It is worth paying attention to. Those who seek to communicate outside of digital structures, to question or challenge the dominant narrative, to deal with ambiguity and nuance, to have discussions rooted in verifiable fact and historical context, are becoming incomprehensible to most of modern society. As soon as they employ a language that is not grounded in the dominant cliches and stereotypes, they are not understood. Television, computers, and smartphones have addicted a generation and conditioned it to talk and think in the irrational, incoherent baby talk it is fed day and day after day. This culture, historical, economic, and social illiteracy delights the ruling elites who design and manage and profit from these sophisticated systems of social control. And armed with our personal data, and they have everything on you, and with the knowledge of our proclivities and habits and desires, they adequately manipulate us as consumers and citizens to accelerate their amazing amounts of wealth and consolidation of power. The only people who grasp the distinction between reality and appearance of reality, who grasp the laws of conduct and society, are the ruling groups and those who do their bidding, and the scientific technical elites who elucidate the laws of behavior and the function of society so that people might be more effectively, albeit unconsciously, governed. That's according to Carey and his communications on his cultures. So, in essence, Trump is a product of this culture decay, not an aberration. The way he speaks and acts and thinks is the way many Americans speak, act, and think. He will one day disappear, but the cultural degeneracy that produced him will remain. Academic institutions, which should be the repositories of culture and literacy, are transforming themselves, often with corporate money, into adjuncts of the digital age, expanding departments to deal with technology and engineering and computer science, the largest major universities such as Princeton and Harvard, while diminishing the disciplines that deal with art and philosophy and ethics and history and politics. These disciplines, rooted in print, are the only antidotes to cultural death. It was intellectual historian Perry Miller, in his essay, The Duty of Mind in a Civilization of Machines, calls us to build our counterweights to communication technology in order to resist the paralyzing effects upon the intellect of the looming nihilism that denies the era. In short, the more we turn off our screens and return to the world of print, the more we seek out the transformative power of art and culture, the more we reestablish genuine relationships conducted face-to-face rather than through a screen, the more we use knowledge to understand and put the world around us in context. Otherwise, prepare yourself for the dystopian digital age of which you are the product. In conclusion, when you think of this unique phenomena, think of all the children who have been damaged by vaccines, always denied by the government, and then until proven that they were right. You're dealing with over 6 million to 7 million Americans. They are denied any reality. They're denied any forum. They're denied credibility, even by the left and liberal community. Now challenge the idea that your children have a chemical imbalance leading to ADHD or ADD, and you're denied any legitimacy. The machine has dictated that if you manifest just these symptoms, you are automatically classified as a disease. So they have pathologized normal behavior, and we have accepted it. They have done this to create controlled consumers for life, and we have accepted it. Challenge genetically modified foods, and you're considered a radical, the other. Challenge the degradation of nature and the implementation of G5 technologies, and you're considered too irascible to be a part of civilized society. You'll be excluded from all power structures, but the power structures will then consider you a local domestic terrorist. Have a thought that challenges the orthodox or group think, and your freedom of speech is censored. This is how far we've come. This is not Aldous Huxley's future. No, this is not Orwell's 1984. This is now. This is the new dystopia. And all you have to do, just like a fake reality show, is look behind the scenes at who's directing, who's producing, who's controlling, who's sponsoring. Don't just look at the characters on the stage. And that's why earlier in this program I said, when we look at a group of people on a foreign relations committee who will pretend to care for our interest and not care at all that there's a war that Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the United States, Great Britain have been fighting in Yemen against the poorest people in the Middle East, with 20 million people, mainly children, at risk and dying, and yet they're not on anyone's agenda. They're not in anyone's talking points or platforms, or the liberation of the Palestinian people, not on anyone's talking points, not on anyone's agenda. Then what do we say one day when we show two books, one's of those who were suffering in Gaza and the West Bank, just as those who suffered in Cape Town in South Africa, just as those who suffered in the Japanese internment camps, just as those who suffered in all these different manifestations. At the same time, everyone else was having a picnic and a holiday and filled with laughter, and they were both done at the same time. What a society. What a mindset. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Mm-hmm.